From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Food. Across the board, it's a deep, deep dive. I guess it's like all things in life. Once you learn a little, you realize how little you actually know. But food in particular gets complicated because it touches everything. Environmental issues, politics, culture, taste, and sometimes religion. For instance, what happens when sustainable choices clash with religious law? Paul Greenberg, author of the books Four Fish and American Catch, examined this conundrum in a recent op-ed for the New York Times. It sent him down a rabbit hole examining the rules and the exceptions of kosher fish.
I should state right up, up front, I'm not a rabbi, I'm not Orthodox, I don't even keep kosher, but I am Jewish. And so I spent some time talking with a couple different rabbis at the Orthodox Union here in New York. And it turns out that the real definition of what makes a kosher fish, it has to have fins and scales. That's pretty much the be-all and end-all. But there's some subtlety in the scale question, because all fish have some kind of scales. The real issue is the scale removable?
Yeah, and I understand that there's four kinds of scales, and two of them are kosher, and two of them are not kosher.
Correct. They are. And if I might refer to my notes here, I think it's the four kinds of scales are clinoid, cycloid, ganoid, and placoid, and only clinoid and cycloid are kosher. So in other words, when you look at a shark, for example, they do have some sort of covering, but that is not a removable covering. And actually, the derivation of it all is pretty interesting. I was delving around online and also going back and forth with the rabbis, and it turns out that the word in Hebrew that they use for scale in the Bible is the same word that they use for Goliath's armor. And so, you know, back and forth they debated, and they eventually decided that a scale like armor needs to be a removable garment, so that if you try to scale a fish and some skin comes off with that scale, then it doesn't count as a removable garment, and then the fish isn't kosher.
Part of me wants to just say that these guys had way too much time on their hands.
They did have a lot of time on their hands, but there's also some interesting debates that I also found. You know, a lot of Jews believe that a fish becomes not kosher because it's a bottom feeder. And that's actually not true. There is, I think, a 13th century commentator named Nachmanides, not Maimonides, but Nachmanides, who kind of interpreted and tried to figure out, well, what was God thinking about when he said no fins, no scales? Was he thinking that maybe – and then Nachmanides, I think, looked at a lot of fish that were, in fact, bottom feeders and kind of thought, well, maybe that would be this inclusive thing, and maybe that's why God doesn't want us to eat those particular fish because they're, you know, rooting around the bottom. But in point of fact, when you look at most lists that are issued by different kosher certifiers, you will find bottom feeders in there as well as top feeders. So cod, which, you know, is one of the great bottom rooters. In fact, you know that little barbel that goes off the bottom of a cod's chin? You ever see a cod haul? That's actually a taste bud. They drag it along the bottom and actually taste the bottom as they swim. So there could be no better example of a bottom feeder than a codfish, and yet a codfish is kosher.
You know, and it seems to me that what makes this even more complicated is sort of a modern version of eating ethically kosher, which sort of embeds a lot of sustainability issues, humane issues into that. So then what happens with salmon, which I think of as being like the poster boy Jewish fish, and all the farmed salmon?
Yeah, well, you know, different sustainability organizations or certifiers out there have different standards for salmon. The Monterey Bay Aquarium, which is probably one of the most consulted lists out there, almost universally gives farmed salmon a red list. Other organizations out there, like I know World Wildlife Fund, if you look at their European lists, put certain farmed salmon on the green list. So it's kind of depends on your organization's sensibilities. The thing I found the most interesting when I kind of delved into this was the question of the genetically modified salmon. That fish, as listeners might know, is composed of actually genetic material from three fish. So an Atlantic salmon, a king salmon, which a growth gene from a king salmon inserted into the Atlantic salmon. And then there's a promoter protein that is stuck onto the king salmon that puts it permanently in the on position. Well, that promoter comes from a fish called the ocean pout. And the ocean pout turns out to be probably not kosher. Probably because I've seen it on lists of not kosher fish, but then when I talk to the New York Orthodox Union, the people who certify fish here in New York, they had not made a ruling on the ocean pout yet because they hadn't actually physically inspected one yet.
But you, in your article that you wrote about this, you quote a rabbi saying that probably it will be certified as kosher. And we should say that that fish has not yet come to the marketplace.
That's right, yes. And what they did say, the rabbis told me, Rabbi Menachem Genick at the Orthodox Union said that the resulting fish that will come out of this genetic combination will be kosher because, again, it's all based on physical appearance. If it has fins and removable scales, that's what matters.
So one of the fish that has always sort of befuddled me, because you always see it in Jewish-style delis right next to the kippered salmon, is the sturgeon.
Yeah. Not kosher most of the time. I mean, so sturgeon, again, it's a primitive fish, so it doesn't have those removable scales. The New York Orthodox Union says, no, it's not kosher. And, geez, what could be more amenable to a sturgeon than New York, you know? But there are some places out there that maintain that possibly juvenile sturgeon might have removable scales. But my overall impression that it is not kosher. Now, why has it become part of the sort of New York smoked fish tradition? I think that there's an overlap to some degree with Eastern European Jews and just Eastern European culture in general. I grew up in a Jewish family, and when I ended up working in Russia for a number of years, I was like, huh, this food is pretty familiar. And so when you look at sturgeon, you know, it's a river fish. It's found in the Volga. It's found in all the great rivers of Eastern Europe. And I think somehow it kind of came along for the ride. And for those who wanted to lapse a little bit, it turns out to be, you know, a very delicious fish when smoked.
Now, what about some of the, quote, invasive species that some people are trying to get us to eat, like lionfish?
So even though lionfish are venomous, if you get pricked by their spines, you get a very nasty sting. But if you fillet them up, they're actually delicious. I've eaten them. I've caught them. But they have removable scales. So their scales will come off. And so those pretty much will pass the kosher test. Asian carp will also pass kosher test. Again, removable scales. You know, another fish, which is kind of an invasive species insofar as it is the sixth most consumed fish in America, the Pangasius catfish, which you might also know in the marketplace as swai or bassa or tra. You'll see it often in the frozen food section of your seafood case. Those are not kosher. It is a catfish, and it does not have visible removable scales.
Wow. What a rabbit hole this is.
It is. But I should say, you know, since you guys are out in California, there is a really great, I think, classic kosher fish that is really great on so many levels from a sustainability point of view, which is the herring. Herring are both on the Pacific and on the Atlantic coast. They are high in omega-3s, low in contaminants. They are incredibly low carbon impact. I can't imagine what would be better to eat from a sustainability point of view and from a kosher point of view and from a health point of view, and some would even say from a taste point of view, than a herring.
But I understand that there are some fishermen that think if we eat too much herring, then we're taking it out of the mouths of larger fish.
Well, there is a big debate right now about forage fish, and a lot of it is also happening on the West Coast. And I think regulators are looking more and more carefully at how big the harvest should be. But if we consider right now that things like herring and sardines and anchovies, that a large portion of the catch is either used for bait or for animal feed, I think there's room for us to scratch our head and say, huh, maybe instead of using it for bait, maybe instead of using it for animal feed, we should just eat it directly, get the fishermen a higher price per pound, and perhaps then we could catch a little less because fishermen are getting paid more. You know, I realize that kind of economics seldom works in the real world, but if you look at it just from a logical point of view, it seems like a good thing to do.
As always, Paul, it's very, very enlightening to have a conversation with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Paul Greenberg. He's the author of two books, Four Fish and American Catch. We've been talking about his New York Times op-ed on sustainable kosher fish. Coming up, break out your oven thermometers. We've got a lot of baking on the horizon. It's homemade challah and the best gifts for the baker in your life. Next.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Welcome back to Good Food. When I realized that Hanukkah was sneaking up on me, I decided to Google the name Joan Nathan and see what popped up. Joan has written innumerable cookbooks on Jewish cooking, and if I ever need inspiration for holiday foods, all I have to do is Google her name. This year, what I found wasn't a latke recipe, but some musings on challah and how her recipe has evolved. Hi, Joan.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm very good.
You know, it's so easy to buy decent challah here in L.A., but you say that challah you bake yourself is worth it. Why?
Well, you know, the minute you ask that question, I think of my hands. You're getting your hands in the dough, and you're making something for people that you love. And I think that there's a real satisfaction in making it, no matter how secular or religious you are. And of course, this is one of the mitzvot of Judaism for Friday night, for a woman to light the candles, to go to the mikvah, and the third is to make challah. And, you know, I'm pretty much of a secular Jew, but I just like doing it, number one. Number two, I love to serve it straight from the oven, and it's, you know, it's not as aerated. I don't care where you get it. It's much more aerated than if you make it yourself, and it's crustier when you make it yourself. So it's just a nice feeling.
What does the word actually mean?
Well, the word challah actually means the portion of the bread that you would throw in the oven. I mean, everybody's done that, a heave offering, right? That you'd take the first bread, the best bread, and put it back into the oven to the gods or God or nature. You know, that's what the concept originally came for. But then it became, as so much in Judaism, a reminder of the temple that was destroyed in Jerusalem, so that you're supposed to remember that. So that's what the challah was. And my guess is, and I'm not sure exactly, but in the Middle Ages, it got to mean the bread of the Sabbath, as opposed to lechem, which is bread during the week. But, you know, the first challah was like a pizza bread. You know, they'd be little round flat objects. And then as Jews spread around and they saw, as you know, as geographically they tasted this rich egg bread that came to Russia, I think, and I'm probably wrong on this, from places like Switzerland, where there had been a tradition of making braided bread. There were whole villages that were transported to the Tsars in Russia. And the Jews, like anybody else, wanted something special for the Sabbath. And what could be better than a brioche-like bread? And then, of course, then it was brought to France from Poland. You know, the king of Poland came to France and settled there and brought the concept of a brioche.
Don't you love that?
I love the way that food travels. And of course, everybody puts their American touch on all these ingredients, which of course, one of them is that it's, you can have challah almost every day in supermarkets, and it's much sweeter than it originally was.
How old were you when the first time you ever made one?
You know, my mother always bought challah. I remember that growing up. And I guess I first started making challah when I started writing about food, and that was in the 70s. I actually had already written my first cookbook called The Flavor of Jerusalem. I was living in Boston, and I interviewed for the Boston Globe magazine a woman who was very, very old. In fact, she died a few months after I interviewed her. Her name was Ada Baum Lipschitz. When she came to the hospital before she died, she made challah and her fingers were just filled with arthritis, but it made her feel good. And I always think about her when I make challah. You know, I watched her make it, and I think I've been making it ever since. And I, you know, as I interview people and as I travel, I've added on to my challah, and I think it's pretty good.
How has it changed over time? Is it less sweet than it used to be?
It's, my challah is less sweet. I don't use as much yeast in it. I let it rise for a longer period of time to suit my schedule.
And I noticed that in your most recent recipe I read, which was in the New York Times, that you added a little bit of orange juice to the loaf.
Right. I've been adding orange juice and, you know, preferably squeezed from the orange that I peel. I used a peel of two oranges in the dough, and it just really flavors it. And then, of course, I use less sugar. And I actually, when I wrote this piece in the Times, there were a lot of comments, why don't you use honey? I actually like the taste of the sugar in the challah better. And so I reduced it. I also reduced the number of eggs. I used to make 4 eggs in the dough, and I found that it was lighter using fewer eggs, and I liked that lightness. And I use less oil. So, you know, it's just a lighter challah, but it also has that denseness of homemade challah.
And when you're braiding it, mm-hmm. what kind of braid do you do?
If I have a lot of time, I 6 braid it, which I really love to do. But if I don't have time, I learned actually this from a woman in France. I mean, I don't know about you, Evan. I love to interview people who are not professional cooks, but who have been cooking their whole lives. And you get so many tips from them. So this woman was a Moroccan woman living in Bordeaux. And I climbed, I would say, 6 flights of stairs to go to her apartment. You know, those wonderful marble, thick stairs that you get in France?
So wonderful.
And I went to her apartment. It was a sort of small apartment, but she was the woman who made challah for the entire Jewish community every Friday. And she didn't have a fancy kitchen or anything like that. So what she did was she would make one long, like a rope, and then not divide it in half, but the two strands together. And then she just twist it. So it was really quick. And then I started doing the same thing. And then, you know, if your dough is good, when you're making challah, you can squish it together so you can make your braids thick as you want or as thin as you want, just depends. And then what I'll do very often is I will make it into a circle, which looks really pretty. We were discussing this last night at a latke festival in New York that I was judging. You can't really reinvent the wheel, especially with something like challah, that you want tradition there. And if you're going to reinvent it, like I added the orange juice and the orange peel, you just want it for flavor, but you want to get still the flavor of challah to be there.
Thank you so much, Joan. It's been wonderful talking with you.
Well, it's been wonderful talking to you. I wish I were in L.A.
Joan Nathan is the author of 10 cookbooks. She's also a frequent contributor to the New York Times, where we first spotted her story on challah. We've got a recipe on the Good Food blog. I want to talk about tools. I'm a firm believer in using what you've got, but when it comes to baking, good tools can be the difference between an ethereal pastry and one that's just okay. I happen to know that Rose Levy Berenbaum is a fanatic about baking tools, from ovens down to measuring spoons. In her latest book, The Baking Bible, the equipment chapter is 16 pages long. So today I thought we'd distill some of that information for you. Hi, Rose.
Hi, Evan.
So are you an accumulator of tools?
Guilty. I'm an equipment junkie. I always say you can bake with very few things, but when you have more of them and when you have the right tool for the task, it makes it so much more fun and it's faster and easier as well.
Where do you keep them all?
Everywhere. Well, actually, I had converted my living room into a kitchen when I lived in New York, but when we moved to Hope, New Jersey in the mountains, we turned the entire basement into a baking kitchen. And now I have a 10-foot closet storage for all my pie pans and cake pans, and it's a really large space. So it's kind of the dream I've had for years.
Wow. So I would love to start this tool conversation with the large and the basic, the oven. Do you have a particular type of oven that if people really are intense hobby bakers, that you think it will work for them better than any other kind?
I remember asking Jeffrey Hamelman what would be the best oven to bake bread in, and he said the best oven is the one that you are familiar with. Each oven is different, and each oven you have to learn the tricks of. But there is a countertop oven that I recommend that's the only truly even oven I think I've ever experienced. And it's not good for a fluted tube pan because it's not quite high enough, but you can bake cookies and you can bake pies in it, and you don't have to turn them around halfway through. It's the Breville oven with a brain, and they have two models. I like the larger one because then you can do just about anything in it. The oven is the soul of baking. That's what baking is. You bake in an oven. And I also think that the oven is the common denominator of failure. When you people have problems with things, it's more often than not the oven temperature.
Let's move on to something smaller. What about mixers?
I've tried every single one out there, I think. And no one thing does everything the best, right? So recently, in the past year, I started using my Ankerström again. That's the bread mixer from Sweden. And it is absolutely fabulous for making bread. It will never wear out. You could use that in a restaurant. But for beating eggs or egg whites or cookie dough, I prefer the KitchenAid or the Cuisinart. You know, you think of Cuisinart as the generic word for a food processor, but they also took over what was originally the Kenwood from England. And that's a wonderful mixer. And I think it's somewhat stronger in motor than the KitchenAid, so it can be used for more brutal things, you know. I also have a bread machine, which I just use for mixing small batches occasionally, but I never bake in a bread machine.
Wow, it sounds like your baking kitchen's like going to baking heaven.
I was just going to say it's a paradise. I love it. But I have to say that, you know, if somebody were to say, what's the most important tool in my kitchen? I could do anything without any of the other things except for a scale. I mean, I think baking by weight is so much easier, faster, and more reliable. So that, to me, is an essential. After that, I would have to say a thermometer. And the best one I found out there is the Thermapen. It's expensive, but it's the best. It's, you know, there's no point using a thermometer if it isn't accurate.
Talking about weight and then volumetric measuring tools, are all volumetric measuring tools the same? For example, if we were to buy, for people who really just don't want to switch to weighing everything, are all of the cup measures the same, or is there, are they all off a little bit?
Oh, I think you've read my book, because that's one of my pet peeves, you know, especially with the liquid measures. They are significantly off. If you were to get a beaker that's used in laboratories, that would be on, because the whole metric weight system is determined by the water. And if they didn't have the marking right, then it would throw everything off. So as far as the solid measures, that's also a big differential. And I worked without even charging him for the guy who produces the Porfect. It's spelled P-O-U-R. He made beakers for solid measure and also for liquid. And I had to tell him where the meniscus was supposed to be. I mean, he really didn't know, but he wanted to do something that was accurate, and he did. So especially with measuring spoons, if people don't have a scale that's accurate to a fraction of a gram, it's better to use measuring spoons for baking powder and for salt. And the measuring spoon set that he does, starting with a 32nd of a teaspoon, going all the way up to, I think, 4 teaspoons, that's more than a tablespoon. There are about 10 different increments, are very accurate, every single one, because I determine what the weight should be. And same thing with his liquid Porfect beakers.
Wow. I love talking to you. It's just incredible. So do you weigh water?
This is funny because my editor at Food Arts, when I used to write for them, when they still existed, that is, apparently he was overheard telling somebody, Rose Levy Barenbaum weighs everything, even air. And I said, well, next time you speak to Jim, ask him if he's ever heard of the concept of gravity, and then he might know the answer to the why I weigh air. If I could. Yes, I weigh water, sure, because it's faster. You know, I mean, and it also is more accurate. So why not? And Evan, if you have time for one more piece of equipment, I'm going to give you the best stocking stuffer hint that I just discovered. Do we have time for that?
Yeah, actually, I was going to ask you for something small and kind of fun.
This is both. I mean, it's unbelievable. I wrote to this guy online, and I said, I've just read about your device called the Crack'em for breaking eggs. And if it works as well as I suspect, I'm going to write about it. And I did, because it's only $5 if you get three of them, $6, I think, if you get one. It is the most brilliantly simple, unbreakable device. It's plastic, it's an oval, and it has a little ridge that's about 2 inches wide by about a half inch high. So when you take the egg and you hit it hard against that ridge, or medium hard, it doesn't really matter, is the beauty of it. It cracks the egg without making the shell break irregularly, so it doesn't get into the mixture, and it never breaks the yolk. So especially when children are learning to bake and you don't have to go through cartons of eggs because they end up breaking it too hard or they're afraid to tap it. Even for adults, I use it. If it's in my upstairs kitchen, I go downstairs. And on downstairs, I go up just to get it. And now I have one in each kitchen. It's the perfect stocking stuffer. Crack'em. C-R-A-C-K apostrophe E-M. You've got to get one.
Thank you so much, Rose.
Thank you, Evan. It's been a delight talking to you and talking about one of my favorite subjects.
That was Rose Levy-Berenbaum. She's written a ton of cookbooks, but is most famous for her Bibles, the latest of which is the Baking Bible. In it, she has a ton of advice on the best baking tools. We also have a list of all the tools she mentioned today on the Good Food blog. Tell me, what kitchen tools could you not live without? Join the conversation on my Facebook page, search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. In a minute, everyone's favorite topic, gluten. We'll talk about the gluten-free backlash, plus flours that taste great and have no gluten. Imagine that.
Food isn't just for eating. It can consume your mind, too. Each week, discover the adventure of good food as we explore other cultures, great restaurants, and meet some fascinating people who make food their center. I'm Evan Kleiman. Join me Saturday mornings for the politics, humor, mystery, and personalities behind our food supply. That's Good Food Saturdays at 11 a.m. here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. I don't have celiac disease, nor do any of my close friends. So for me to cook gluten-free, it has to be about more than a medical imperative. It has to be about flavor and texture, which is why I find Flavor Flowers, the new book by seasoned pro teacher and cookbook author Alice Medrich, so intriguing. She sees alternative flours as heroes, each a star in its own right, rather than as substitutes for something else. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Evan.
I have to say, you know, going back to Kim Boyce's book, Good to the Grain, which I feel like was the first book that came out of its kind exploring alternative grains 10 years ago. And now looking at your book, Flavor Flowers, it's so interesting how different they are and how much time has passed in terms of how the market has filled in with all of these different kinds of flowers.
This is exactly so. A couple of years before Kim, I stopped walking by those flowers in the market, and I brought some of them into a few recipes in my book, Pure Dessert. And I used them as flavor and texture, and I used them with wheat flour, which meant that I didn't have huge challenges in terms of structure and, you know, making them function. And I found them delicious and interesting. And I remember thinking, oh, these are interesting. I'm not done here. And in the intervening time, especially since Kim, who did such a bigger job of it, there are more of them, partly because of the celiac and gluten-free community and partly because of the interest in whole grains. But so now, this many years later, I set this huge challenge for myself, which was to let go of the wheat flour in these recipes and deal with these flours on their own or sometimes in partnership with each other, but without the support of wheat, which gives us the gluten structure, which is the backbone of all of our Western baking.
Are you particularly interested in using like an all-purpose blend?
Not at all. I know that the gluten-free community does this because the idea is to recreate all the things they miss. But because I was interested more in the specific flavors and textures of these flours, which I consider beautiful and flavorful, I did not necessarily want to blend them unless I was blending for flavor.
So I want to really focus on chestnut and buckwheat. But before we do that, I want you to talk to me a minute about oat flour, because you found in baking with oat flour that it has a very particular flavor profile that I think most of us would never even imagine.
I know. We all of us know oat flour. We eat oatmeal. We like it or we hate it, but we think we know what it tastes like. And so much of that is driven by the texture we connect with it. But when you take those oats and grind them into a very fine flour, it enables you to make other things than what we expect of oats and oatmeal. It allows us to make fine-grained cakes and cookies that are different than oatmeal cookies because we're not using oats per se. And suddenly, flavors that we hadn't noticed are apparent, like a little butterscotchy kind of flavor, toffee butterscotch flavor from the oat flour. So when I make a genoise or a sponge cake out of oat flour, I'm tasting this lovely butterscotch, and the cake doesn't need anything else. It's so delicious that I could knock it a whole cake off every time I walk by, you know, a little piece at a time, every time I walk by it in the kitchen, and I have done so.
Okay, let's talk about chestnut flour. This is a flour that, because we have had no chestnut trees here for so long, right, most Americans are very unfamiliar with because of my Italophileness.
Yeah.
I kind of am familiar with chestnut flour, and it's something that I really love using.
I love it, too. And it has these different reputations. Here, it's a special thing. You know, it's roasted chestnuts maybe on the street corner if you live in New York or certain cities. Sometimes it gets into stuffing. But we don't know it as flour. And I'm not sure how many of us have even roasted it and eaten them. I mean, I have. In Italy, it has a reputation of being a flour of the poor. And, you know, that goes both ways. We celebrate some of those things now. We love it. We rediscover it. I actually don't know if chestnut is properly really a nut or just called a nut, but has a starchy texture almost like sweet potato or yam or something. And it has a sweetness about it. And the good chestnut flours, and I found a couple sources in the States here, have a sweet, yummy flavor. Some of the Italians are smoky because of the way they're drying them, I guess. But I've chosen the sweetest, most delicious ones and made all kinds of things.
I have to say that what I mostly use chestnut flour for is making crepes, which I then pair with ricotta and chestnut honey. So for me, it's sort of like
it's
a
easy
theme.
Yeah.
But tell me where you went with chestnut flour.
The first thing, I made a genoise, a sort of classic French sponge cake out of them. The chestnut one was delicious. It was, again, it was a standalone. You could eat, it looks, you know, plain and naked and not very exciting alone, but you could eat it alone. And then you take that, you could take that and eat it with the flavors that you love with it, with a little ricotta, with some figs, with some, you know, pear butter or apple butter or honey. All of those combinations work really well. A little jam tart, which again is a reference to Italian. That jam tart, I forget what it's called in
Fregolata?
Yeah, fregolata. I made a fregolata out of it where I mixed it with butter and a little bit of cream cheese, smeared it in the pan, you know, put some jam on top and baked it.
Do you find that across all the flours, there are any techniques that you ended up using over and over again, like resting doughs or?
A lot of these flours, not the chestnuts specifically, but a lot of the ones that are whole grains, needed adequate hydration. In other words, a little more liquid than we might have used for wheat flour, and sometimes a rest, often a rest. If it was a cookie dough or a shortbread or a tart crust kind of thing, although I think this is true even with wheat flour, a rest is good for hydration to allow the dough to absorb the liquid. 2 hours, but better still overnight, which I like to turn into a positive. It's a do-ahead, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about buckwheat, the flour that perhaps has the most forward kind of flavor. Some people would say aggressive. I love buckwheat.
I love it too. But people do love it or hate it. If you grew up with kasha, you love it or hate it, right?
I love it.
I love it, but not everybody does. It has it seems to have a very forward, aggressive, earthy flavor that people might not like, or it might be an acquired taste. However, used in a really light sponge cake or a sour cream souffle, suddenly there are these flavors of rose and honey, delicate floral flavors that just knocked me off my chair. I didn't expect it. And in other recipes, you're getting that earthy, earthy, woodsy.
You use it in a Linzer cookie.
Uh-huh.
where you make the sablé, and then, of course, it's sandwiched with a little bit of jam. Are you using any other flours, like rice flour?
There's rice. Rice often is a partner. It tends to open up the flavors of some of these other flours, just the way it seems to amplify the flavors of any other ingredient. If you use rice flour with chocolate, you get more powerful chocolate flavor. If you use rice flour with lemon, it seems to make a wonderful stage where you amplify the flavor of the lemon. And even in something plain like a butter biscuit, it amplifies the flavor of the butter.
Is there a kind of rice flour you like better than, or you use more often than any other? It seems like that is the flour where there's many different choices.
Well, the most of the choices with rice have to do with where you get it from and how fine it is, which is a little bit of a pain in the neck because that affects measurements a little bit. But in this book, we're using white rice, and that's a sort of basic backdrop flavor, though we sometimes use it alone, and it's brilliant in a chiffon cake. The flavor is gorgeous. It's this gorgeous floral rice flavor. Who knew? I mean, it's like an angel food cake with way more character.
Well, Alice, what a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Eva.
And what a great book. I can't wait to cook from it.
Thank you. I'm very excited about it.
That was Alice Medrich. Her new book is Flavor Flowers. We've got a recipe for her buckwheat Linzer cookies on the Good Food blog. If one can eat wheat-based breads and pastries with impunity, it's easy to discount the extraordinary rise of the market for gluten-free goods with a simple swipe of sarcasm. Yet this dismissal denies the hardship of those with serious gluten intolerance or celiac, which is millions of people, a full 1% of the U.S. population. In her moving essay, Gut Instincts, Heather Abel shares her story of lifelong pain, a lack of diagnosis, and what this says about the state of a medical community unwilling to grapple with a disease that has no easy pharmaceutical answer. Hi, Heather.
Hi.
I feel like we've kind of passed the gluten-free fad and moved into an area of gluten-free backlash.
Definitely.
Yeah, you mentioned in your Slate article recent instances, one on South Park.
Mm-hmm.
And one in The New Yorker. Could you describe them?
Sure. The South Park episode was called, the name of it was actually called Gluten-Free Ebola. And in that episode, gluten is banned in the town because they discover it's detrimental for everybody. And if someone is found eating gluten, one of the characters' fathers was, men in hazmat suits come and take them and quarantine them in Papa John's. And then in the end, a way of eating is found that can save the world. So that's the South Park. That was just a few months ago. New Yorker cartoons are interesting because it really seemed like for a while, every time I picked up the New Yorker, either in the cartoons or in Shouts and Murmurs, there was a lampoon of my diet. So one of the ones that particularly bothers me is the one of two people eating, and one of the people at a restaurant says, I've only been gluten-free for a week, but I'm already really annoying.
Yeah, I have to say that I've probably said my fair share of snarky things about gluten-free diet. But I really think that part of it comes from this free-floating sense of anxiety, and one doesn't know where truth and not fantasy, but extreme anxiety collide. And it must be very particularly so when you're dealing with a disease that has so little diagnosis and so few answers.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons I wrote the Slate piece is because I lived for almost 30 years without a diagnosis. I didn't actually know that there was something wrong with me. I thought I just was someone whose body was pretty messed up. And I didn't actually believe I was going to find a diagnosis. No doctor had ever suggested that. I went from doctor to doctor. And so I tried out lots of fad diets in my 20s starting around 14, bothering my parents to no end, bothering friends, until I was finally diagnosed. And so I really felt like I had a lot of sympathy for people out there those people who are awaiting diagnosis, those people like me who have had a diagnosis of a disease but still have a lot of trouble figuring out what to eat that really works for them.
So had you been symptomatic your entire life?
I have, yeah. Starting, you know, with my earliest memories, I had stomach aches. And I also really hated gluten, which was interesting. I hated pizza. I hated pasta. So there was a lot of foods that I just avoided. Even when I was young, I was waitressing in San Francisco at a vegetarian restaurant, a really, you know, healthy little restaurant. And though every single thing in the menu had gluten in it because of soy sauce, except for one dish, and that was the only dish I liked. Now, this was way before gluten was talked about. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know it was in soy sauce. So there was a way that I just naturally resisted gluten foods. But I had no idea.
How did you finally get diagnosed?
Well, I was living in New York City, and I had health insurance for the first time in about since I went off my parents' plan. So I was 28 at the time. So I had my first own health insurance through graduate school. And I went in because I had a terrible pain in my neck and shoulders. And it had been going on for months. I couldn't turn my head. I couldn't type. I couldn't lift anything. I went in and met with a doctor. I went in and met with bunches of doctors. And I finally found one who would listen to me. And she did some blood work. And she said, oh, you're terribly anemic. We need to give you an endoscopy. You might have an ulcer. And I said, really, don't worry about it. I've always been anemic. I've always had problems with my stomach. There's nothing wrong. But she insisted. When I awoke from being under from the endoscopy, I was told by the doctors I had the worst case of celiac disease they'd ever seen. And this was in the year 2000.
Are doctors trained to look for symptoms?
Well, increasingly they are, but for a long time they really weren't. And from what I hear from doctor friends, it's being talked about more and more. But it's still often talked about as a GI disease, that it will present with symptoms of stomach aches, that people will be malnourished. Always in the textbooks, they showed a child with twiggy legs and a paunched out belly and said, this is what you'll see. If you see this, this kid might have celiac disease. And there was, you know, maybe one paragraph about it. But what we're learning now is that people have celiac disease who are overweight. People have it who don't have any GI symptoms at all, who have neurological symptoms, who have skin, problems with skin or problems with fertility, that it really can attack any of the functions of the body.
I understand that in Europe, this is not so, that there has been a longer history of celiac awareness and understanding of it as an immune disorder.
Yeah, there has been. There's been much more research. So in the 1950s, that's when celiac started to become defined as a disease that was based on damage to the villi because of gluten. And before that, celiac disease existed, but no one really knew what caused it. And with the advent of the endoscopy, or the earliest endoscopies, someone in Denmark said, oh, this is caused by gluten, and that became what celiac was. Now, after that, countries in Europe continued to research about it, learn about it, talk about it, train doctors about it, and it really stopped in the U.S. So the suspicion is that because the U.S. medical system is so based on getting money from pharmaceutical companies, this is a disease that people suddenly realized had no pharmaceutical cure. It could be entirely cured by diet. And there was really no money to study it. There still is much less money to study celiac disease than there is for similar diseases that do have pharmaceutical cures.
You wrote a Kindle single called Gut Instinct, and I have to say that the part that was most poignant for me was this idea of people being told that, you know, they have, quote, female problems, or they're just under too much stress.
Yes. There was some study, it was a while ago, but it did say that for the average person with celiac, it took 11 years from when they first started to find a diagnosis for their multitudinous problems to when they actually were diagnosed with celiac disease. And those are really tough years, especially because so much of what you're told during that time is it's all in your head, you have anxiety, you need to calm down, you're psychosomatic, you're depressed. that there's something you're doing wrong. And that is when you seek out healers, you seek out any kind of information you can find on the internet.
And is there a certain subset of people who have celiac who actually don't respond to a gluten-free diet?
There are. There are people whose bodies don't heal from it and whose the damage to the villi is too severe, and the villi don't grow back in the intestines. Because what happens when you have celiac undiagnosed is you eat gluten, your body thinks that you're eating poison, and the villi, the little hairs on the intestines that line the intestines that absorb your nutrients, break off and fall away. They atrophy off. And so there are some people, a small percentage, who upon starting the gluten-free diet, their villi don't grow back or don't grow back enough.
It's just so sad.
It is. It's sad and it's very widespread and it's very undiagnosed in our country.
Thank you so much, Heather. It's really, both your articles are just so heartfelt and filled with information. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Heather Abel's essay is called Gut Instincts, Dispatches from the Wide Open Space Between Sickness and Health. You can download the Kindle single on Amazon. Up next, Callahan's Restaurant has been in business for 68 years. Wow. At the end of the year, it will close its doors for good. Some of the regulars have been eating one, two, even three meals a day there for years. Where they will go now remains to be determined. Stay close.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. That sting you feel when your favorite restaurant closes? Some Santa Monica residents are feeling that in a big way right now after learning that Callahan's, a venerable and unassuming place on Wilshire Boulevard, is closing its doors after 68 years in business. The modestly priced neighborhood diner is a vanishing breed throughout Los Angeles. Gideon Brower paid a final visit to Callahan's to capture some of the voices and atmosphere that have made the place so beloved by its many regular patrons.
This is a very popular restaurant. It's been here forever.
I got some people that eat at least one meal a day, or some people that eat two. Some people eat three meals a day.
Sundays, it's a lot of families. Saturdays, a lot of couples. During the week, it's a lot of singles.
You have Liz. You have Mary. They know everybody. The customers know who you are because you're identified when you come in and when they leave. Liz always says their name, so you know who they are.
It's almost like that bar atmosphere, you know, like you're talking to the bartender, the regulars. Eileen comes in, usually sits in the booth behind us. Thin as a rail, but she has a chocolate sundae after every meal.
Teachers, retirees, professors, movie producers, a lot of writers.
Mick Jagger came in here, sat at the counter.
Do you want potatoes with yours, or cottage cheese, or fruit?
The food is very familiar feeling. It's not pretentious.
It's nothing super fancy. There's no kale involved. I like that.
I get the eggs either over medium or scrambled.
Eggs and potatoes and biscuit.
South of the border omelet with tomatoes, chiles, and avocado.
The prices have always been kept low. It's available to people.
It's big enough so you feel comfortable. It's not loud.
You have the booths. You have the chairs at the counter, and they swivel.
People would say, oh, you guys should remodel. But no, we wanted to keep the same feel of the 50s. Because you know what? There's not that many restaurants here in Santa Monica with the same feel, the diner feel.
Now, what kind of toast? White wheat rye, sourdough? English
I market. First knew Elizabeth, whom you see here now, when she was just out of high school. Her brother, we've talked sports for over 20 years.
Now, my sister was here since they got the place since 88, and then she just passed away back in April. A memorial service was held at St. Monica. She had over 1,000 people there. And one of our customers, he says, Liz, I went to Lucille Ball's funeral at St. Monica, and I want to tell you something. Letty, your sister, had more people than Lucille Ball, her funeral. Half of the people are her customers.
Spinach and mushroom, omelette.
And tomato.
Everything is changing in Santa Monica. I mean, all this development, different kind of communities probably moving in. So that's why all these old school places gotta go. If we could keep at least one, but I'm pretty sure they're all gonna go.
Once we close down, I mean, I feel sorry for a lot of them because they're gonna feel lost without Callahan's.
I don't know where I'm gonna go. Where can you get three cups of coffee for two and a half? Not very many places.
Okay, thank you.
That story was produced by Gideon Brower and made possible by KCRW's Independent Producer Project. The voices you heard in that story were Abraham Vasquez, Elizabeth Vasquez, Dean Andrews, Nancy Morse, Bob Smith, Ann Benefram, Kevin Krakauer, Charlotte Walter, Bob Kornheim, and Pedro Lopez. Gideon reports Callahan's will be open through December 31st. Next year, a farm-to-table diner concept will take its place. The Vienna Pastry Shop that currently shares the building will remain for the time being. I want to take a moment to remember all the restaurants we lost and those serving their last days in 2014. I know from personal experience that loss felt from both the operator and customer side. Allumette, Ashe, the very last Hamburger Hamlet, Hatfield's, Kate Mantellini, La Botte, Red Bread, Red Medicine, Le Ca, Encounters at the Airport, Chaya Brasserie in Beverly Hills, plus Rivera will close at the end of the year. And the Cat in the Fennel turned off patio lights last week. I know I'm missing a long list of others, all of which had their regulars who will miss them. And yet, for every restaurant that closes, another one opens. And we rely on Jonathan Gold to fill us in on the latest great restaurants across Los Angeles. He is, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. And in case you haven't heard, he's the subject of a forthcoming documentary called City of Gold, which is debuting at Sundance next month. We'll have more on that next year. But right now, Jonathan's in the studio to talk about yet another high-profile downtown restaurant. This one, called LA Chapter, is inside the Ace Hotel near the intersection of Olympic and Broadway.
The place is really exciting if you go there like before or after a show, because you always see people in the band or people, performers, like wandering through, and everybody's excited, and the six people that you started out eating with are probably not the six people you're going to end up eating with.
Yeah, it's really vibrant.
And let's just say there's nothing that you would expect that would be on this menu that is not on this menu. Are there blackened shishito peppers? Of course there are. I mean, every menu has those these days. There's a kale salad. There's gem lettuce with goat cheese and the sort of like pistachio coffee crumble that tastes like something you would probably have on a cake instead of a salad. But, you know, it's fine.
I'm an aficionado of gem lettuce, so hey.
You can always brush it off. And it seems to be this trend of, like, burned vegetables that everybody's doing now. I mean, you can't have broccolini unless you're going to show it some serious fire.
So it's a restaurant in a hotel. Is there a burger?
Of course there's a burger. The two guys who run the place have roots in Australia. One cooked at an Australian-themed restaurant in New York for years, and the other one is from New Zealand. So their signature burger has, in the Australian manner, beets, fried eggs, and grilled pineapple.
Which is like a very traditional Australian burger, for those who don't know.
I'm always amazed to go to a tour like a Burger King in Australia and see that the burger has beets and fried egg on it.
Yep.
There's a regular burger, too, that doesn't have the beets. The thing I liked best was, oddly enough, one of the main dishes. It was king salmon. It had to have been sous vide, right? So it was extremely rare. It looked raw, but it had a velvety texture, didn't have that weird, stringy nastiness of raw salmon. And it was served kind of Greek, Middle Eastern, Russian, but with, they call it tzatziki, but, you know, with nuts and beets.
Oh, that's interesting.
Instead of the spinach that you'd expect. You know, it was a really solid dish. They had a solid pork chop with pickled nectarines. They make their own ricotta in the back, which is variable. Sometimes it's, you know, sort of dry and mealy, and sometimes it's luscious.
You know, recently we talked about Roy Choi's restaurant in another hotel, the commissary. Do you think that looking at this menu, that they're catering to some of the things that people expect when they're staying in a hotel? Or do you think this restaurant is much more sort of a restaurant that just happens to be in a hotel?
During the day, they have a regular hotel menu. I mean, they're known for their brunches. You can get avocado toast. Of course you can get avocado toast. There are ricotta pancakes with berries and banana, because of course they're ricotta pancakes. But the Ace Hotel doesn't really draw the club sandwich crowd. I mean, people who are staying at that hotel seem to be staying there for, you know, specific countercultural reasons, which isn't necessarily the case at the Line Hotel in Koreatown, where Roy Choi is doing his thing.
Interesting. What is the space like?
The building is converted from part of the United Artists Theater, you know, this splendid Art Deco thing, financed by Mary Pickford, actually, in the 20s. And there's this sort of almost aggressive Art Deco feel about it, not sort of the opulent Art Deco that you would associate with a place like, say, the Old Rex. It's more jazzy and more jagged, and you have the feeling when it's busy that you're in a place where something is really happening.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks, Evan.
Jonathan Gold is the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about LA Chapter at the Ace Hotel in downtown LA. Get a text with the restaurant's name, address, and Jonathan's recommended dishes by texting Good Food to 69866. Plus, find all of Jonathan's restaurant recommendations on Good Food's restaurant map. It's on the Good Food blog. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on demand on KCRW's smartphone apps. Thanks so much to everyone who made the entire year's worth of shows possible. Jillian, Laryl, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan Kleiman. Have a wonderful holiday, however you choose to celebrate. And join me back here next week for our very last show of 2014.